You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including the termination of a district's fire chief in the Rogue Valley, the launch of a dugout canoe in the Klamath River, and new homeless camping sites in Grants Pass. I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm James Kelly, JPR's news intern for the summer.
James, we're going to start with you. You drove down 3 hours south last month to cover a big event in far northern California. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So last month, the Karuk tribe in northern California launched its first canoe that has been built by the tribe in 60 years into the Klamath River. They gathered in Orleans, California, which is one of the towns that the tribe has some of its government buildings in, the other two being Happy Camp and Wairika. And it was a big event, you know. There were tribal members and their families there, elders, children. I was there with, a documentary crew from Berkeley, which was pretty cool. And it was a really beautiful event. They took turns, you know, tribal members and their families going out in the canoe and paddling around the river. One of the carvers was sitting at the head of the boat, you know, hitting a drum and singing. And really the bottom line is the tribe has had a hard time over the last 60 years, getting one of their own canoes into their ancestral waters, and water that they have used and relied on for generations.
Mm-hmm. So the first canoe that has been built by the tribe in 60 years launched into the Klamath River. Can you tell us a little bit about the actual canoe itself?
Yeah, so it was carved over three different workshops in May by members of the tribe. And one of the guys I interviewed sort of worked on it quietly on his own when it was being kept in his backyard. You know, he said he couldn't really put it to rest, so he would just go out and work on it. But it was a really, by and large, communal effort to construct this canoe. One of the carvers, who was a bit younger, he told me he was watching and learning for future generations. But the actual canoe itself was about 18 feet long, had three or four planks for sitting, and it's so about that many people could fit into the boat at one time. And it was pretty thin. It was a dark charcoal color, but a really beautiful boat. And they built it using sugar pine logs that were left over from the nearby McCash fire.
Okay. And I should say that we do have, obviously, your story on our website, and there's some photos of the canoe there as well if people want to take a look at that. So what were some of the challenges that the tribe has faced in making the canoe?
So it all sort of starts in the 1960s when this huge flood swept through southern Oregon and northern California and basically flushed out all of their canoes, like all of them. And the people I talked to were able to basically corroborate this. And this comes, you know, right in the middle of, but, you know, a period that started just before the flood of termination, is what it's called, when the U.S. government basically instituted policies to strip indigenous peoples of their land, their government. And this was also that the federal government could have more control over them, basically. And so the Karuk tribe's access to many of their natural resources that they'd had for generations became severely limited, especially since they do not have a reservation, despite them being one of the largest tribes in the state of California. And so for decades, this is what they were dealing with. They were borrowing canoes from the Hoopa and Yurok tribes, basically, for decades until 2019, 2020. And this is when one tribal member, who's named Grant Gilkison, he had this idea to bring Karuk-built canoes back to their ancestral waters. And so he got moving on this project with the help of some local organizations that helped provide funding and helped him write grant proposals so that he could try to get the funding to build the logs to build the canoe. And all of these different steps were sort of challenging, and basically he did it. But unfortunately, Grant passed away in 2020. So he didn't really get to see all of the culmination of, you know, his hard work and all the time he's put into this. And this event was really to honor him. You know, many of his family members were people that I spoke with while I was there. And so it was a really beautiful thing. And now they are planning to build at least two more boats with logs from the same sugar pine tree. This is the tree that they use the log for to build the canoe that they launched last month. And they said they're hoping to complete the next boat by the end of September. And really, it's this big process of reclaiming a generations-old tradition that has been taken from them.
That's really cool. Thanks, James.
Jane, we're going to turn to you this time. You covered a big decision this week at a fire district here in the Rogue Valley. What happened there?
So we're talking about Jackson County Fire District 5, which has three fire stations in Phoenix and Talent and unincorporated Ashland. They serve over 23,000 people. And on Tuesday night, the board of directors fired their chief, whose name is Charles Hanley. The reasons for that termination were that the district had hired an independent investigator who was investigating some claims against former Chief Hanley, and three of them were found to be sustained. There are eight other claims that have yet to be investigated, but the three that were sustained involved covering up sexual harassment, bullying, and interfering with the governmental promotion board. So the board said on Tuesday night that was enough to fire him. They unanimously voted to do so. There was one member that was absent, so the vote was 4-0. And they fired him with cause, effective immediately on Tuesday. They had a long executive session first. And I should say that I did reach out to Hanley for comment, and he has not responded.
Yeah, wow, that sounds like a lot. There's obviously must be some history here with this. What happened? What's been happening here?
Yeah, there is some history. So Hanley has been on paid administrative leave since May. There have been allegations that the district leadership failed to address inappropriate workplace conduct. So in February, the union had asked the board of directors to take action because there had been repeated complaints about inappropriate conduct in the department. The union said that behavior had been going on for years and had created a toxic culture of bullying and harassment. And the union president Brady Graham said in February that the district had failed to address the behavior, which included sexual harassment. So, and then Hanley was on paid administrative leave in May, and then back in March, three out of the five members of the board of directors suddenly resigned. So then they didn't have a quorum. They were down to two members. And then it took another month for the Jackson County Board of Commissioners to appoint three new members to the board in April. So now they've got a full five members, a new board, and they're trying to work and move forward.
Yeah. And we're finally able to do this stuff.
Right.
So what happens now then for the district?
So I talked to the union president and interim fire chief Aaron Bustard, and they say that this is sort of a step forward in a lot of ways. There's a lot of talk about moving forward and improving employee morale and sort of this being a new place to start from. So here's the union president, Brady Graham.
I think it is a beginning to us rebuilding from just the absolute brokenness caused by mismanagement of an organization and mismanagement to an extreme extent.
So the board has another meeting coming up on Tuesday, the 13th. They're going to be discussing the district's financial situation and will be giving a briefing to the public on their finances, if anyone wants to attend that. And then also sort of separately on Tuesday, they were discussing two other instances of potential impropriety in the district. One of them involved a $10,000 check from the Firehouse Five Foundation, which is a nonprofit in Phoenix that supports the district firefighters. And the board members had some concerns about how or whether that check was used. And there's a second concern that was focused on an unnamed former board member who had potentially used property that belonged to the district in a private manner. So the board gave us just that much information, and they say that they're looking into those allegations too. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, interesting. You've basically been on our evening meeting watch this
yes.
past week, a lot of different meetings. You covered another one, which was the decision from the Grants Pass City Council. What did they decide this week?
So the Grants Pass City Council voted on Wednesday night to designate four specific sites in the city. They're all city-owned property, and that will be where homeless people will be allowed to camp. So there's four sites. They're almost 3 acres in total, and they will have chain-link fencing, accessible bathrooms, hand-washing stations, trash service. Two of them are also going to have security camera trailers. And they're going to cost the city over $250,000 a year. I should say that these are sort of temporary residences. People cannot camp there indefinitely. They have to move to a different site, a different of these four sites, every certain number of hours. So that part is a little bit complicated. I do explain it a little bit more in the story on our website, and I have the addresses of where these specific sites are in the story as well.
Interesting. For those who don't know, why is homelessness and these camping sites important, especially for Grants Pass?
Yeah, so because this all sort of relates back to a decision that I've talked about before that was made by the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of June, there was this longstanding legal case in Grants Pass about homelessness, and the court ruled in the city's favor and upheld the city's ban on camping in public. But the city of Grants Pass still has to follow Oregon state law, which says that cities have to be, quote, objectively reasonable as they regulate where people can camp. So since the Supreme Court's ruling, Grants Pass has been working to designate certain locations in the city where homeless people will be allowed to camp. You know, Grants Pass, like much of Oregon, much of the West Coast, is dealing with a homeless problem and crisis and trying to find ways to address that. So on Wednesday, they approved these four sites. They might add some additional sites in the future. They also might discuss adding potable water sources at these sites. And also we're going to discuss how this might work with car camping. So people who camp in their cars, if they don't have a tent, how that might work. And there was a little bit of pushback from residents and some concerns with these sites, but the city council was just saying, you know, this is a start. We got to start somewhere and we'll adjust as we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these new sites, are they in effect right now?
No. And that's a little bit complicated also. So the timeline for when these new rules will actually be enforced is a little bit uncertain. So there was the Supreme Court ruling, but Grants Pass is still actually under a federal district court injunction as part of the ongoing legal case. And so those new sites won't be enforced until the injunction is lifted. And the city manager said Wednesday night he doesn't know exactly when the injunction will be lifted. So the thought is whenever the injunction is lifted, the city will have this plan already in place. They can put it into action to make sure they're following state law. And then the new rule will be enforced, which will mean that these four sites will be the only places in the city that homeless people will be allowed to camp.
Got it. Great. Thanks, Jane.
And I'm going to turn around to you, Roman. You reported on a number of questions that were placed on the November ballot in Coos Curry and Josephine counties this week. And let's start with Josephine County. There's a vote on a property tax. What would that tax go towards?
So this tax would go towards the specific county department called the Veterans Service Office. They help veterans access different state and federal benefits. What they said was that, you know, these benefits are really complicated to access, and it can be really difficult for veterans to figure out which benefits they're able to access and how they apply for them because they're all over the place. So things like GI Bill benefits, education assistance, healthcare benefits, all sorts of things. So they have these like case managers who help with this stuff. So this tax was proposed by the VSO as a way to raise a stable funding source. According to them, well, and the way the tax work, it would be a tax of 5 cents per $1,000 of assessed property value. So in human terms, that means that for the average home in the county, that's assessed value is at around $220,000. The cost would be around $11 a year. And so that would raise around $2.7 million over 5 years for the VSO, which they say is around enough for them to, you know, survive on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why is the tax needed?
So the director of the VSO, her name is Lisa Pickhart. She said that they need a more stable funding source. They got a really big funding cut. I think it was almost $100,000 in their most recent budget. And that led to, you know, a lot of staff. They had to cut a couple of staff. They had to cut services. So they want a stable funding source outside of the general fund. But I think the important thing to note here and why this is important is that Josephine County voters have historically voted down increases in taxes. It took a lot of time and multiple failures before voters narrowly approved a public safety tax to fund the sheriff's department last year. Mm-hmm. So we're not really sure if voters will approve this tax. But veterans who are at the meeting this week were optimistic because it's a significantly smaller tax than the public safety one and has a very clear purpose, which is to support veterans.
Right. Okay. So that's Josephine County. And then you also reported on two advisory questions from the two southernmost counties on the Oregon coast, which were approved this week. And what are these coastal commissioners asking their voters?
Yeah, so these aren't taxes here. Instead, they're essentially putting these like opinion polls on the ballot. They want to know if residents want commissioners to continue their active opposition to these floating offshore wind farms. These would be what's called an advisory question. They're non-binding. They wouldn't force the commissioners to do anything, but it would, you know, gauge their opinion on what voters are thinking to help guide their actions in the future. So these floating offshore wind farms, there's these two proposed offshore wind farms on the southern Oregon coast. The federal government, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, is planning to auction off these two sections of ocean to different companies in October, which would then develop these huge floating offshore wind farms with these giant turbines, blades the size of football fields. They're massive. These would be some of the first offshore wind farms on the West Coast. A couple of other leases were leased off in California a couple years ago, and these would be enough and generate enough power to power over 1 million homes. So, you know, they would create these giant wind farms, and that's what commissioners want to know, is if they should remain in opposition to them.
And can you tell us briefly why commissioners have been opposed to offshore wind?
Yeah, I think the biggest reasons are impacts on the fishing industry, who's going to pay for the transmission upgrades to bring the power to shore, wildfire risk. I think that there were some you know, people bring in some misleading claims about the offshore wind turbines at the meeting. So we'll kind of see what voters think there. You know, they don't necessarily know what voters actually do think about this.
Sure. And that's the point of the vote. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Roman. And that's it for this week's debrief. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.